I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison is my guest for the hour. He joins the Baltimore Police Department after nearly three decades in law enforcement in New Orleans. His challenges here are Herculean. In just the week since he was sworn in, gun violence has claimed the lives of seven people and left an 11-year-old boy maimed in a South Baltimore playground. Can Michael Harrison restore morale to a force that's been rocked by scandal and command changes? And can he rekindle confidence in the BPD among residents who live in neighborhoods long plagued by violence? Michael Harrison succeeded in reducing violence, implementing a consent decree, and rooting out police corruption in New Orleans. Can he do it here? Commissioner Harrison joins me right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for tuning in with us. Last Monday, the Baltimore City Council unanimously approved Michael Harrison as the city's 41st police commissioner. He was sworn in the next day as the first permanent chief of police the city has had in 10 months, the fourth chief cop in the last 14 months. Commissioner Harrison is 49 years old. He and his wife, Cece, have two adult children. He has spent the past few weeks introducing himself to the people of Baltimore at a series of community meetings. He comes to the BPD after nearly 30 years with the New Orleans Police Department, which he joined as a new recruit in 1991. Like Baltimore, the New Orleans force has been operating under a consent decree, facing the challenge of historically high rates of violent crime and the need to regain the trust of the public after several scandals. We'll take your calls a little bit later in the program. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with us via email, our address is midday@wypr.org. You can also tweet at @MiddayWYPR. Commissioner, welcome to Midday and welcome to Baltimore, sir.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
So you've said, sir, in these series of community meetings that you've been holding over the past few weeks in all nine districts, that you want the Baltimore Police Department to be one of the best police departments in the country. What for you are the metrics for that a year from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now?
Well, first of all, that's a great question. And there are the same metrics that we had for the New Orleans Police Department, who went from what the Department of Justice called in 2012 the most troubled department in America to what was just printed in the local paper a week or so ago as a model department. How did they go from the most troubled department to a model department? And those metrics then will apply now. It will be the ability to reduce crime, the ability to have good performance metrics, and systems of accountability that inform us about good performance, about bad performance, and accountability at every level, where we hold ourselves accountable and, you know, we're accountable to the community that we serve. And so in addition to being able to reduce crime, just creating a well-run organization that is extremely accountable and transparent, high citizen satisfaction. And when I started there as the chief in 14, it was about 29%. And then when I left, it was above 67%. And so that's remarkable citizen satisfaction, and then coming into compliance with a consent decree. And so I started there in year two, and then after leaving a few months ago in year six, we were above 90% compliance. That's record time, which meant there's a 100% transformation of the department. So like New Orleans, Baltimore is not required to change one or two things, but really overhaul its department with policies, protocols, practices, training, in delivery of services, engagement. Everything we do has to be transformed and overhauled. So I would say the metrics are crime reduction, citizen satisfaction, citizens' perceptions of crime as well, which go hand in hand with citizen satisfaction, and then compliance with this consent decree. And when you see all of those things improving over time, those are the metrics by which we will be able to say the country called us one type of department, and now we're a model department who can show other departments how to self-correct and transform themselves.
When you talk about reducing crime, what's the capacity of the Baltimore Police Department, or for that many, any matter any police department, to prevent crimes from occurring and also to solve the crimes that have been committed, because both of those aspects have been troublesome for our police department in prior years. I mean, what is the actual capacity, in your view, for our police department to do both of those things?
Man, you bring up two very good points. And over the 9 community meetings that we held, where I was taking questions for over 2 hours each night, and then again in the presence of the city council taking their questions for a couple of hours, I mentioned to the people of Baltimore about capacity. You know, we have to have capacity, which I think is there's some promise here in the Baltimore Police Departments, and I think there's some people who have great capacity and will, but the department as a whole has a capacity issue, and we are working now to identify those capacity gaps and to fill those gaps by finding, number one, the people who have the right skill sets to be in the right positions and holding the right ranks and having those skill sets to address the capacity deficiency. There's a technology capacity deficiency. To do the things that other great police departments are doing, we have to build the capacity to have a good technology platform by which we build all the technology upon. And so I can't even at this point buy the greatest piece of technology off of the shelf, because we have to build the platform and the infrastructure to support it, and that the technologies don't yet communicate with the other technologies. Everything works in silos. And so we have to overcome that, build good technology, but build human capacity by investing in our personnel at every level, so that supervisors and mid-level managers and upper level and command staff and executive staff all can perform at a very, very high level, along with the implementation of great technology and smart initiatives. And when you put those together, we then enhance and build capacity. But there's a human deficiency also. We're short quite a few hundred people. So though we need to transform and become this well-run organization with people who can perform at a high level, we need to really bring people on faster and keep more people here and make sure that our retention is good. And so all of those things are the capacity gaps that exist that we have to overcome. So to answer your question specifically, those are the things we need to do as a department, but it's in conjunction with the entire criminal justice system that has, in my professional opinion, really weak or lacking consequences for a lot of violent offenses, which deters people, or should be deterring people, from making those bad decisions to commit crime on the front end. All right, and so we need to really work to strengthen the part of the criminal justice system that has certain, not necessarily severe, but certain consequences, because it's the certainty of punishment that deters crime, not the severity of punishment. And while we're doing that on the back end and building this really good, well-run police department, we need to be making sure we're delivering services to people that treat mental health and drug abuse and the education system, jobs and skills or the lack thereof, opportunities and housing and poverty. We need to be addressing all of that. And so there are capacity deficiencies in the front end with what I just mentioned. In our department, we're working to build that, and on the back end with systems that deter and punishments and consequences that deter bad actions. We're working on all that here in Baltimore. I think there's a lot of promise, but there are a lot of capacity deficiencies in all three areas.
Last year, in 2018, the department had a 43.4% clearance rate of crime. So in terms of solving crimes, identifying perpetrators, bringing them to trial, do you expect that rate will get better? Will it? You know, will we be in the 60, 70, 80% clearance rate sphere anytime soon?
Well, I think you're speaking about the clearance rate for all crime. And when you look at that, you have to look at it for all crime, but then you have to break it down crime by crime. So what's the clearance rate for robberies, for non-fatal shootings, and for homicides independently also? The clearance rates are tied to the capacity and the skill set and capacity of the investigators, but that's also tied to the relationship we have with our community, who we desperately need to provide information for us to clear those cases. And so while there's sometimes physical evidence that we might collect, many of our cases rely on eyewitness testimony. And when there's a high mistrust for police and for law enforcement, communication is lacking, information is lacking and not free-flowing, and we more often than not do not get the cooperation of a community who we desperately need to clear cases and to inform us about things when there's no physical evidence to clear a case. And so all of that has to be improved, but that speaks directly to our level of community engagement, our proactive community policing strategic initiatives that really go out there and build relationships, repair relationships, so that communication can flow. And on top of collecting physical evidence, we have the capacity and the willingness to be able to meet citizens where they are who would provide us information that we desperately need. And so that capacity to increase clearance rates goes hand in hand with improving relationships with the people who live and work here in Baltimore. And only when we do that can we expect that the clearance rates can improve, improving the relationships with our community, building trust with the community, building technological capacity, improving the skill sets of the investigators, and to a large degree, adding more people to do the work of investigations so that the investigators are not so overburdened that they're not giving proper due attention to a case, which could be a factor as well. And so we're working to correct all of those things at the same time, all the time.
I do believe, sir, I am correct in stating that 43.4% clearance rate is for homicides themselves.
Okay. Okay. So that's not the overall. That's specifically for homicides.
Right.
So, yes.
But and I attended one of your community meetings in Reservoir Hill, and you gave, as I said, 9 of them. You appeared in a meeting in each of the police districts around the city. And it was interesting because the questions that you got according at the one that I was at and the press reports that I read about the other ones, there was this tension in communities between too much policing and, of course, unconstitutional policing that some communities have become quite used to, and the consent decree addresses that, but also not enough policing, people thinking that the cops simply were not around and they were difficult to find, and when you called 911, it was a long time before you found them or before they arrived on the scene. What's your take, having been on the job now 5 weeks, in terms of the balance between particularly neighborhoods where high crime has been an endemic problem for a long time, in terms of the presence of the police, when you talk about community policing programs and protocols, the presence of police and how that presence can translate into reduced crime levels?
Great question. What you heard was different depending on where you were in the city. Different people want different things, and policing looks different in different communities. And what I envision in a well-run policing organization is district commanders and the police leadership having the authority and autonomy to be able to make adjustments to the delivery of police services. Excuse me. And so in one area, there may be different levels of enforcement to deter crime and prevent crime, displace it, or even apprehend people who commit it. And then in other areas, it's really just engagement because perceptions of crime are very, very different and perceptions of police are very different. But we have to be flexible to be able to adjust. But that comes with making sure that we invest in the professional development of our leadership and giving them the best policing education that we can so that they're well informed on the needs of people, how to engage with community to create deployment strategies that are community-based and have community input to deliver the services that are expected by the community, and not just giving them what we believe they need, but rather giving the community what the community deserves or needs based on what they say they need, because it's going to be different in different communities. But that comes with education, that comes with professional development, that comes with professional maturity, at the mid-level management and at the command level and the executive level of a police department. And I've heard in each of those meetings that sometimes we're over-policing, sometimes we're under-policing. That speaks to a culture of a police department, and that culture is driven by public outcry or public sentiment, and whether or not citizens are trusting of police are because people really, you know, people really only trust police when they really need the police. And when you don't need the police, perhaps you can have a different viewpoint. I want to make sure that we have the correct culture in our department that's service-minded, that's customer service-oriented, that we deliver great customer service, but we are balanced enough to know that we're treating behaviors and we're not treating people, and we're policing and we're dealing with bad behaviors and not necessarily people. And you may have heard me say we want to be hard on crime but soft on people. And making sure our people really understand what that means. But we have to have the flexibility to adjust, but that only comes with education and training, which there's a deficiency here, and we want to overcome that by investing in our personnel.
There's a big piece in the New York Times that ran in the Sunday magazine just a couple of days ago by Alec McGillis, a very respected reporter for ProPublica. Alex is actually going to be a guest on our program on Thursday. And he talks about the beat cops with whom he spoke, who said that they felt very constrained by the consent decree. He described a pullback of policing. He called it undeclared and unmistakably deliberate. What have you heard about that? What's your impression about the narrative that says that there have been people in the Baltimore Police Department since the riots and uprising of 2015 that have, the phrase is, you know, taken a knee?
We experienced that a little bit in New Orleans, and we're experiencing that here, where I've gone. Not only did I go around to all of the districts to meet with the community members, I've been working around the city to meet with officers personally to hear directly from them as well. And what, in my professional opinion, my 28 years and almost 5 years as a police chief of a major city now, what I hear from community members is that police are not being assertive. They're not being aggressive. We're taking a knee, metaphorically, if you will. When cops tell you they feel handcuffed or restrained and are not able to do their jobs, they will blame it on the consent decree. That is translated to me as a policing professional. I don't quite know how to do the new thing that they're expecting me to do because I used to do it the old way. And I think with training and education, because the laws have not changed, Fourth Amendment is still the same, you know, the laws have not changed. All we're asking officers to do is to do the same thing in a constitutional way. And so it comes with training and education on how to do it the appropriate way. And I think what's being translated is when they say I'm being handcuffed or I can't do my job or I feel restrained, what they're saying is the consent decree puts so many administrative burdens on me that it is almost not worth the effort because I now have to document everything that I do, and I document it well, and it comes with great scrutiny and oversight. And so I believe that's just translated. It's not worth it. It does not mean that we're not doing it because the officers I see are going out there doing a pretty good job every day. And I'm encouraging them to be proactive, to be aggressive, but not abusive. There's a difference between aggressive and abusive. We want to be aggressive and assertive, but not abusive, because we want people to know that, number one, we care. Number one, we can do something about the problem they're bringing to us.
Michael Harrison is the new commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department. And Commissioner, I beg your indulgence, we got to take a quick break, but we will come back and follow up on this point and others. We'll have more with the commissioner after a quick break. When we come back, we will try to sneak in some of your calls and comments. Our phone number at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, my guest tomorrow will be the commissioner of the city's Department of Housing and Community Development, Michael Braverman. I'll ask him about a new initiative to demolish a number of vacant houses and the city's targeted community development strategy. Commissioner Michael Braverman joins me tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the new commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department, Michael Harrison. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to drop us a tweet at Midday WYPR, to follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall WYPR. Commissioner, if we could, I want to pick up on a point you were making before the break. You mentioned that there's an administrative burden that accompanies the consent decree in terms of how officers follow up and actions that they may or may not take. But what I'm hearing from a lot of beat cops is it's not just an administrative burden. They're just simply, they are reticent to get involved given what happened in 2015. I mean, 130 officers were injured in the riots and violence that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray. Six officers were indicted for the way they apprehended Mr. Gray, who died, of course, in custody. And they are, and none of those officers were convicted. But and obviously the city was quite torn about that whole incident and series of incidents. But they're simply afraid to a certain extent, and perhaps that's not too powerful a word, too harsh a word. They are reluctant at best to get involved in certain situations in which they think they may expose themselves to that kind of prosecution themselves. How do you think about that?
Well, first of all, you bring up a great point, but I want to go back because there are two distinct points. One was the first before the break was the point about the consent decree, and so there's a. When they talk about I can't do my job or I feel restrained, they're talking about the amount of administrative burdens that go along with now the work we do, that we didn't have to do so much of that or any of it prior to the consent decree. Now there's a lot of administrative burdens attached to every single task and documents and reports to be written and a lot of follow-up. That's part A. Part B is you are correct, but it's a distinct point. That they are afraid of being the next national viral video. They are afraid of getting in trouble either administratively or criminally for performing or failing to perform a certain task that some may view us was out of bounds. And there's a natural fear there here and everywhere in America. We experienced it in New Orleans and we're experiencing it here. But we overcome that with good training, good policies, protocols and practices, and the evolution of policies and training that change when the best practices change. And as long as people feel confident and then become competent in their skill sets, they're more likely to go and perform a task. And I think right now there's a disparity between the lack of competence in the skill sets and the policies and training that we're putting out because they're all new. And so as we put out new policies, we have to train to them. And I think with good leadership and strong policies and good supervision, we can get our members to a point where they feel confident and competent to go out and perform. But they have to know that their department has their back when they do the right thing and that when they are performing their task for the overall good, that we encourage that. And certainly we want to point out when we make mistakes and when officers do the wrong thing. But when we do the right thing, we have to reward that, and we have to have I think they think the department, the city government, or the federal government doesn't have their back. And it really is about doing the right thing and doing it the right way. And we support officers when they do it the right way.
Michael Harrison is my guest. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Mr. Harrison is the new commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department. Let's go to the phones, Commissioner, if you wouldn't mind answering a few listener questions. Myra in North Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Commissioner Harrison.
Hello. Yes, I appreciate the discussion about the quote-unquote stand down. You still there?
Yes, ma'am. You're on the air.
Thank you. I turned the radio off. And I wanted to add to the conversation, I did a tree survey in the city, which allowed me a lot of opportunity to be on the ground watching a lot of things. And in Northwest, witnessed open-air drug trafficking near a school in the middle of the day, and a police officer parked in an alley. And I struck up a conversation with me, and he didn't say, you know, it was too much paperwork. He didn't say he was afraid to do anything. What he told me was he was told, couldn't tell me who, but somebody above him, not to do anything.
When was this, Myra?
this was about a year ago. And you know, being discouraged about that. And I mean, he was just sitting there a block away from these kids exchanging drugs in the middle of the day near school.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call, Myra. I appreciate it. Commissioner, we do hear these stories of, you know, officers sitting in their cars and not patrolling, not getting out, not meeting people, not seeing what's going on. This event that Myra relates is a year old. Is that still happening now? I mean, are you confident that kind of thing, that's a sort of basic tenet of policing, Is that sort of thing, do you think, becoming a thing of the past in terms of procedures?
I think it's becoming a thing of the past. I will say that on my very first day, you know, I attended a community meeting that night, and, you know, nine more after that. And on my very first day, I heard that very same thing that this caller talked about, and I heard it every night, as a matter of fact, in every part of the city. That there were open-air drug markets and officers would be sitting in a car nearby not doing anything. I can't speak to what the officer was told a year ago. I have communicated to the members of this department that we do not want them just sitting in cars. We want them to get out. And I personally put out a message by way of a video that I mandated everyone see, to get out the car, engage. Now, I think there is an unrealistic expectation that if there's an open-air drug market with multiple people out there and a single officer is in the car, that the one officer can get out and confront a large group of people. That's unsafe. And so there are officers who are tasked with dealing with that covertly and overtly. But I want to make sure we just manage the expectations appropriately. That one officer walking up to a group of six or seven, you may not even know who the person selling the drugs are. You might know. But how to make that approach safely, if someone takes off running, what do you do? And if they begin to struggle, you're by yourself. So there are mechanisms in place to do that effectively, but it can't be done with just one officer. But sitting in the car doing nothing or giving the perception that you're doing nothing is what we want to get away from. And so I've charged people to get out the cars, engage in a non-enforcement capacity so we can start building the relationships that weren't built and repairing broken relationships and changing the perception of what we do and how we do it. So that's already in the works, and that was one of my early messages my first week. So I don't know if it's fully a thing of the past, but I've already taken measures to do something very differently.
And Commissioner, so much of this comes down to trust, and there's two parts of the trust, it seems to me. The first is, as you've just mentioned, repairing relationships with communities and having the police be trusted by the community so that communities will cooperate with the police in investigations and that they will feel confident that the police can, in fact, keep them safe. The other is the police trusting you as their new commander. I have friends in New Orleans who tell me that the city and the department were in mourning when you announced the fact that you were moving to Baltimore. You were deeply and deeply respected and admired in New Orleans. Does it take that kind of allegiance, if you will, that kind of affection for you personally as a commander in order for you to change the culture of the BPD? And you talk so often at these community meetings about the need for the culture of the organization to change.
I was born and raised in New Orleans, and I'm grateful for that compliment. I don't know that the citizens mourned when I left, but they certainly showed me how much they appreciated me being there, and it's a great compliment. But I had a great team, and I worked for great mayors, and they gave me great support, and I was able to do all of the things that I envisioned as a leader because I had the support of two great mayors, great city council members, past and present. And great community, and I was equally the police chief of the department and of the citizens, and I advocated equally for my department to get the best resources, training, professional development, and to move them into being a great department. But I advocated equally for the community to make sure we built relationships, and they had access to me and our department, and we were transparent and accountable, and there were no questions that went unanswered. And, you know, anything they wanted to know about our department, it was at their fingertips. And so we built that over time. It was not on the first day. You know, that's how they felt when I left. That is not how they felt when I started. And so it will take time. But it will be demonstrating to my officers our officers, that I support them and that I will invest in their development and teach them and coach them and mentor them and cultivate them and train them to be the best that they can be. And by also advocating for our citizens that I'm your commissioner too. And I want to deliver the best department to you that's open and honest and transparent and compassionate and empathetic. And that can actually solve the problems you bring to us. And so it's a lot to work on, but we're doing all of that over time through citizens. You heard me talk about citizen satisfaction surveys. I've already began the process of commissioning one to be conducted really soon here. Over time, I hope to see citizen satisfaction increase, officer morale increase, and their belief that I delivered the correct level of leadership, the correct type of leadership to this organization. Over time, I hope to see that, and when the appropriate time comes, they will have hopefully good things to say about my time here, and the citizens will then view our department very differently than they do now.
Aside from the consent decree, which obviously you've read, aside from the DOJ report that came out at the end of the summer in 2016 that had so many critical claims to make about unconstitutional policing on behalf of people in the department, and all the media reports that I'm sure you've read, or many, about the culture of the department. We have the GTTF scandal, a large criminal enterprise run by people who are putatively among the most elite people in the force. We have the specter of a predecessor in your position, Daryl D'Souza, federal prosecutors recommending that he go to jail for a year for tax evasion, and intimating in that indictment and in that recommendation that there are many others in the Baltimore Police Department who are involved in tax fraud as well. What is your impression? I mean, it's one thing for the rest of us to sit around and say, here's our impression of the culture of corruption in the Baltimore Police Department. But what's your impression now, 5-6 weeks into the job?
Well, first of all, what I don't want to do is cast dispersions and paint the department with a broad brush. I will say that there are people who have obviously done the wrong thing and not the right thing, and it has come to light. But there are many hardworking, really honest, and good people here in the Baltimore Police Department who are looking for strong, decisive leadership. For us to self-correct, course-correct, and put this train back on the tracks. And I believe that their hearts, minds, and souls are fully invested into this police department. For those who have done the wrong thing, and for those who might even remain, who did not get caught, we have to build systems of accountability that inform us on how to notice and observe patterns of bad behavior and bad performance, and then have systems of accountability that help us course correct that, and then systems that inform us for those who fail to course correct and take the appropriate action, so that supervisors are held accountable for their lack of action and decisive action when they find things are not done correctly or when things are done wrong, up all the way to the top. And so it really has to be the systems of accountability, both technological and human systems, that inform us on a daily basis, or really minute by minute, when things go well, when things don't go well, and making sure people who have the right skill set, will, and capacity are in these management positions to take the appropriate actions. And when they don't take the appropriate actions, we course correct with either training or discipline or removal of those people.
Commissioner, we'd like to get to one more phone call before we take another quick break. Let's go to Frank in Mount Washington. Welcome to Midday with Commissioner Harrison.
Hello, Tom. Thank you. Commissioner Harrison, welcome to Baltimore, first of all.
Thank you so much.
I like what I'm hearing from you so far. It sounds to me you're going to begin by your investment of time and resources in the people in your department. But I also like the fact that you pointed out that jobs, education, and housing are also linked to good policing of a healthy city. How do you propose in your position as police commissioner to convince the other city agencies to increase their capacity to serve and to achieve, and that they can, so that policing becomes a higher level and a higher satisfaction because we're now seeing the housing department, we're now seeing corporations looking to Baltimore, where the investment in the schools means that there are people that can do the jobs that are going to bring jobs to Baltimore. They're all interrelated, and they come back to policing. How, as you upgrade the police department, will you convince and encourage other city agencies to change their culture for a higher level of achievement?
Thanks for that call, Frank.
Yeah, that's a great question, and thank you. And I started on my very first day socializing those concepts to members of the community, members of our city government. You know, certainly our mayor understands that I believe that and fully understand the sociological connection to root causes of crime, and that's exactly what you're speaking of. And when there are deficiencies in all of the sociological things that have to be treated and run right, people are going to become what's called criminally innovative to accomplish their goals. We accomplish our goals through legitimate means, but, you know, people will accomplish their goals in different ways. We want to make sure we can speak to, so while it may not be in my shop to provide good housing, I have to be able to at least bring the message to the appropriate people. With my expertise as a major city chief now in the second city going on 5 years, I believe there's some credibility that's now allowing me to speak to that, and people are listening. And I've said it to our city council, our city government, and the community at large over a two-week period, that we have to be able to deliver housing and education, skills, jobs, mental health and drug abuse, conflict resolution, parenting skills, environmental design, all of that has to change. And notice police was nowhere in what I just said, you know, but all of that has to work, because those are the things that when they don't work properly, they cause people to choose crime out of necessity sometimes. And we then become reactive to just chasing it. But then we get held accountable for it when it is all of that caused it.
Michael Harrison is Baltimore City's new police commissioner. We'll have more with the commissioner when we come back from a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is the new commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department, Michael Harrison. He was sworn in as the 41st chief of police a week ago today, having served in an interim capacity since the 11th of February. You can join us here on Midday at 410-662-8780. A note to callers, we have a number of people waiting in line to speak to the commissioner. We'll get to some of them, certainly, and we ask that you keep your comments and questions brief. You can send us an email to midday@wypr.org, or you can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. Commissioner, in addition to changing the culture of the department itself, how do you view your capacity to change the culture of the street, to change the culture that leads to hundreds and hundreds of homicides every year? 20%, nearly 20% of the people who died in violence on Baltimore streets last year had been previously shot in non-fatal shootings. 84% had previous arrest records. 48% had previous gun crime arrests. So there is a culture that has an awful lot of people armed and an awful lot of people, as the saying goes, taking the law into their own hands. What do you as a police chief, and what do you as a department have? What arrows in your quiver do you have to change that culture?
Well, you bring up a really good point, and so while I'm charged with correcting and reshaping the police department and creating the correct culture here, I think I have to have my political colleagues join me at every level, local, state, and federal, and our federal partners in creating the dialogue about what's really needed and why the culture exists. And we have to just be honest about it, but it can't just be me. I have to maybe lead the discussion, but I have to be joined by our state officials and prosecutors, our federal prosecutors, but the advocacy groups that are out in the community, and our local political environment has to join me in creating the dialogue and come to the acceptance that these are the root causes of crime. We have to address that because there are far too many guns and people are using them. And the point I want to make here that I've made everywhere I've gone, the decision point to pull the trigger is not made when the trigger is pulled. The decision point to pull the trigger on a gun in a violent crime is made when a person decides to leave home with the gun. When you grab that gun and you walk out the door with it, you've predetermined in your mind that if I need to use it, I will. And so the decision's already made. You know, we're kind of responding to it, and we can be in every place, but the decision is already inside of the mind of the person who's committing the act. So we have to change that culture, but it's going to take all of us, our faith leaders, our academics, our activists, our media. We all have to be on the same page so that we can get our political environment to give us some strength in our laws that are so strong that they deter people from those bad actions.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned
all of that has to work together. And I started off the conversation by saying that.
Yeah, you mentioned it's not the severity of the crime, and there's been a long discussion about the efficacy of mandatory minimum sentences, et cetera. You said it's the certainty of punishment that will deter people. I mean, is that a big part of changing the culture of people making that decision to walk out of the house with the gun?
I think the knowing that if they got caught, that there's certain punishment that they will receive, and that it could be severe, but it is really certain, and that our department becomes the well-run department that produces good quality investigations that make it through, and we're abiding by Fourth Amendment, and we're doing it in a constitutional way. When we, as we rebuild doing that, and those laws get stronger, and then we communicate the message appropriately to our community, I believe it can change. You know, I point to New York City that has the toughest gun laws but have the least amount of shootings and murders and has the lowest murder rate in all of America, but have really, really strong gun laws. We can have the very same thing. I'm not saying we have to be identical to that, but we have to do things differently because people are dying. And they're dying because people are using these guns. They're carrying them illegally, and they're using them. You can't use it if you don't carry it. So we have to really think about how we deter people from doing that and changing that culture.
Let's go to Farah in Harford County. Welcome to Midday with Commissioner Harrison.
Hi. I just want to preface my question with I actually have a loved one who's a Baltimore City police officer, and one of the things I've noticed that really puts a strain on the department is not only the recruitment of police officers, but also the retention and development of the police officers that you currently have. So I was wondering if there's any sort of plan moving forward to address the issue.
Thanks for the call.
Absolutely, and that's a great point. And I think I mentioned that earlier in the show. It's not just bringing in new people, but it's keeping the great people that we have. And it's really about cultivating and development and grooming the people who are here and then supporting them. And so that they have two things, confidence in what they do and competence in what they do. But that comes with great education and training that we're working to bring top-notch training here at every level. And then making sure we really speak to the reasons why people leave. People don't leave organizations because we're talking about retention. They don't leave not necessarily because of pay. It's usually, number one, working conditions. Number two, upward mobility, the ability to promote up. Number three, feeling part of a team. And number four is usually pay. And that's usually across all public and private sector jobs. And so we're working to improve those working conditions so this can not only be an attractive place to stay, but an attractive place to stay, and that we show the members who are here that they have high value and that they feel part of a team.
We hear reports that, for example, a number of police officers in the city have left to go to work for Baltimore County. There are fears that if Johns Hopkins University is given permission by the legislature to form its own private police force, that they could recruit some people who are currently on the BPD. Do you worry about that?
Well, those are always concerns, but I think as the commissioner now, it's my job to advocate and to get resources to improve our conditions, work conditions, technology conditions, pay conditions, manpower conditions, And so that's always a concern. I don't think we need to be overly concerned, but we need to make sure that we're cultivating and developing and speaking to the whole person who works for us so that they feel valued here, so that even when somebody else offers something, they feel valued enough to believe that this is a place worth staying.
Let's go to Hamid in Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Commissioner Harrison.
How you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. So I heard on this discussion, we talked a lot about accountability, and we talked a lot about, kind of changing the culture within the police force. For the citizens, so they'll have more trust. But I think one thing that has been brought up within the community, and I live in Baltimore, I live downtown actually, is there's a lack of trust due to the police officers' Bill of Rights. You know, the Bill of Rights gives officers what citizens believe is an unfair amount of time to, you know, mull over an investigation that they're involved in, or there's not any drug testing done with police officers when they're involved into a shooting or an incident. There's no alcohol test that's done. And we've recently seen a police officer die from a drug overdose. So,
yeah, Hamid, that's a really good point. I appreciate it. I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're almost out of time. But Commissioner, what about the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights? Where do you stand on that?
Well, that was brought to my attention very early on. That's a concern that I have. I'm getting to learn the Maryland laws, that one in particular. I just want to make sure that we can bring the best practices here and the best training. And we're not the police officers here are not afforded any more than any other police officers anywhere else in any other state. And so what we want to make sure we're transparent. And I think part of the trust that the gentleman was talking about, some of that we can overcome with transparency. So right now we're recording everything we do on body cameras, and there's a level of transparency that we need to get so at least the residents of Baltimore understand the process and the outcomes. And a lot of times, a lot of the mistrust is not necessarily from the practice, because something could have been a good practice, but it's the transparency about what happened. And so we're working to develop and strengthen all of that so that we can build trust. As the caller stated.
What about residency requirements for people who join the Baltimore City Police Department? Do you believe that that's a good idea?
I think, to be honest with you, in an ideal, perfect scenario, in a perfect world, that's always great. I had that in New Orleans. But there's a low percentage of officers who live in the city now and a low percentage who live in most big cities. In a perfect world, that's great, and I do support it, but we don't live in that perfect world. Even in New Orleans, 60% of every class came from out of state, people that were moving in, and it was extremely challenging to recruit from our own city. I'm finding that now that I'm the new commissioner here, we have that very same challenge. But there's a new opportunity that we're embarking upon, and I don't want to reveal too much too soon, but we're working on strategies to identify and recruit more talent from Baltimore to be members of the Baltimore Police Department with incentives to live inside of the city and incentives to be Baltimore police officers. So we're thinking about that, and we're trying to grow that demographic right now because it's a very important demographic. Ideally, it would not be possible to run a police department if we put that mandate on us right now.
Commissioner, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I appreciate your time this afternoon. I know you're a very busy guy. Thank you very much, and good luck and Godspeed, sir.
Thank you so much, and thank you to your callers.
Michael Harrison is the new commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department. That is it for us this afternoon. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recognized by the Daily Meal. You can find a menu and hours at joesquared.com. Coming up tomorrow, another commissioner, the commissioner of Baltimore City's Department of Housing and Community Development, Michael Braverman, will join me here in Studio A. Hope you'll join us as well. We're going to talk about tearing down a bunch of vacant houses, getting rid of blight, and making affordable housing available to more folks. Hope you'll also stay tuned for Here and Now. That's coming up after the NPR newscast at the top of this hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for your tweets and your emails. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.